www.wakethesleepinggiant.info.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We also have here as our guest Dr. Robert Bocek. He's pediatrician and clinical assistant professor at the U of I and has for some time now been stopping by in the program once a month. It's always on a Thursday, and we talk about children's health. And we built it into the schedule a long time ago because we thought that parents would always have questions about children's health, and it would be good to have a regular opportunity to do it. So whatever might be on your mind, it can have to do with illness or wellness, can have to do with behavior or development or anything that you could imagine discussing with a pediatrician. Well, you can do that here on the show. And all you have to do is give us a call, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL or 9455. That's the local number, 333-9455. And we do also have toll-free, again, and that's 800-222-9455. Well, welcome back.
Well, good morning. It's good to be back.
A couple of weeks ago here, we had our family practice doctor on the show, Jeff Swearingen, and I asked him about were we pretty much done with flu, and he said, yes, I think we can say we're officially at the end of the flu season. And I've been feeling crummy for about the last 5 weeks, so as far as I'm concerned, it hasn't helped me. Yeah. But I guess we're probably, now that we're into spring, probably we are. Are we really done, you think, with flu?
Yes. I was at my old office recently at Christie Clinic, and they said the allergies are now coming in. The infectious diseases seem to be gone, and now the nasal allergies are coming in because it is beautiful out there, isn't it? Everything is blooming.
Everything is blooming.
And hopefully those of you out there with allergies are feeling better today after the drenching rain we had last night. The air should be cleaner. Of pollen, and you should be feeling better tomorrow.
Yeah. That's something that you do see in children, too?
Oh, yes. And I think that, you know, again, the treatment's the same. And, you know, if you're suffering from nasal allergies, if you're suffering from asthma, that's a different case. If you're suffering from nasal allergies, probably the place to start is with an over-the-counter antihistamine, diphenhydramine, or one of those. And the problem with the over-the-counter antihistamine, well, they're good stuff, but sometimes the side effects, they make you sleepy. Mm-hmm. So then you can try one of the non-sedating antihistamines and see if they work. And then you can move up to the nasal steroids. And I think there's a lot more treatment options that we have for nasal allergies now than the old Benadryl that made a lot of people excessively sleepy and was intolerable.
So you can actually try what's available over the counter.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. And if that, if that works fine, and if the side effects are tolerable, great. And if not, talk to your physician. And there's a progression up the pharmaceutical chain, and usually something will work.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to. Please don't suffer in silence. Something will work.
Right, and it does seem to be that the case that the older, you know, that that old reliable Benadryl really it does work really well.
Yeah.
But the problem is the sedating side effect, which is sometimes not so bad. You can always take it at bedtime. And that's not a problem.
Yeah.
I think some people would say, well, the newer ones that promise to be less sedating, maybe they actually don't work quite as well.
They may not work. Yeah. And I think often with medications in these cases is, you know, for some people they work and for some people they don't. If they don't work, tell your doctor about it or try a different medication if you're using an over-the-counter or if you're using a prescription medication. Just tell your doctor doesn't work, you'd like to try something else. And often one that's closely related in the same family maybe won't work, and the other one that's sort of the same, closely related will work. And you don't need to suffer in silence. There's probably relief out there for you.
Yeah. Seems that one thing that has been in the news a little bit lately is pertussis. I remember hearing some stories here that apparently it was in Muhammad in high school. They had some confirmed cases of pertussis. And I think earlier this winter we were kind of talking about pertussis. It's one of those things that I think for a long time we hardly talked about at all. And it just seems like now people are saying, well, it is out there. You know, it does exist, and it is something of concern when you really talk about small kids. For an adult, maybe it's a nuisance, but yeah. it's not all that serious.
Yeah, I'm not sure that this isn't a bit of media terrorism, if you will. I think, you know, I think we've known forever that the present pertussis vaccine is good, gives you immunity for about 7 years, and 7 years, 10 years, something like that, and then it's gone. And the old wholesale pertussis vaccine really wasn't tolerated very well after about 7 to 10 years of age. I mean, it worked, except you had an arm that you'd, yeah, the local reaction was so bad you had an arm you couldn't use for 3 or 4 days. And most people said, and the disease by this time is fairly mild. It's much milder. It's got a cough that lingers and lasts, bad cough that lingers and lasts for, 6 or 8 weeks or so. And the vaccine just wasn't used in adults. But we knew that, you got your last dose at age 5, so by age 12 or 15, you weren't covered. You were eligible for pertussis, and, you know, these people came in with a prolonged cough. You gave them some cough medicine with codeine that didn't work very well and sent them on their way, said they're going to be okay. And now, for some reason, I guess people are looking for pertussis, and not surprisingly, they're finding it in the older age groups. And to the best of my knowledge, it still is in the older age groups. The good news is this may be changing, because we've talked about the acellular pertussis vaccine. We talked about the old wholesale pertussis vaccine, where you take Bordetella pertussis, the bacteria, and you kill it, and you chop it up, and you inject it in somebody, and there's all kinds of stuff you want in there, and there's all kinds of other stuff in this vaccine, and that's probably what caused the reaction. And the so-called acellular pertussis vaccine has the more specific antigens that seem to protect against the vaccine seem to protect against the disease, and the side effects are indeed much lower. And they're testing that in adults now, and it appears that that may be licensed for adults. So what the upshot of this will be to look for in the future is every 10 years, as Dr. Swearingen said, you're supposed to get your diphtheria tetanus booster. Well, it's now going to be you're going to get your diphtheria pertussis tetanus booster, and only it's going to be the acellular pertussis vaccine. The reaction rate should be low. The protection should be high. And then we won't have to worry about, then the adult population won't have these prolonged coughs, and we won't have to worry about the young infants who are the ones that die of whooping cough.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's something. So you think that would continue to be the only thing? I think that's the only thing. Right now, the diphtheria tetanus is the only vaccination that adults had recommended. You get this periodic booster, and I guess until you get to be of a certain age, then you might want to do pneumonia. But other than that, that's pretty much it.
That's it, yeah.
Okay. Well, questions are certainly welcome here in this hour of Focus 580. If you have questions about children's health, you can call us, and the number 333-9455. That's for here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I guess I thought I would ask just, and I think I actually did talk a little bit about this with Dr. Jeff, but it is something I know that we've talked about, and that is fifth disease. A colleague of mine recently had apparently a raging outbreak of fifth disease in his house. Jeff did, but you can tell a story of how it is this poor disease never really got a name.
Measles had a number once upon a time, and I think scarlet fever had a number once, and for some reason, this disease never got a name. There was first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and I think there was sixth disease, too, and they all got names, and this poor disease didn't get a name, and it's caused by a parvovirus, and for the most part, it's a who cares in the scheme of things. Most people aren't sick. They have a rash with it, but they aren't sick. And it's characteristically a slap cheek appearance. It looks, the cheeks get very red, and supposedly you get a lacy-like rash on the body. Generally, it doesn't itch. It lasts a few days. By the time the rash appears, they're not contagious anymore. before the rash appears, they are, but they aren't sick, so they don't know they're contagious. And again, in the general scheme of things, it's a who cares. But parvovirus has the propensity to shut off bone marrow temporarily. So those of us who are walking around with hemoglobins of 15 or 16, which is about normal for males, especially females are a little bit lower, our hemoglobin drops down to 12 or 13 or 14. And again, that's sort of a who cares. The normal person doesn't just really, I work perfectly fine with a hemoglobin of 13 or 14. But kids with sickle cell disease or kids with certain other diseases can get into big trouble. They can get in sort of an aplastic crisis. If your hemoglobin's 10 and it drops down to 7, you will begin to notice that. So for some people, it's a serious problem. For pregnant women, it can be a problem occasionally in the fetus, that it shuts down the bone marrow of the fetus, so they can be in trouble. But generally, FIFS disease is, yeah, it's usually a warm-weathered illness. And generally, it's a who cares. Mm-hmm. But sometimes some people do care.
Right. Well, we have a couple of callers here to talk with, and let's do that. Starting with a caller in Champaign and line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Good morning. I've got a couple of questions, some related to what y'all have been talking about already. The thing with allergies, I've got a 10-month-old, and both myself and my husband suffer from allergies pretty badly. And, now our son, 10-month-old, is looking like he continuously has a runny nose. Now, he's at daycare, and that might have something to do with it, but it just doesn't seem to go away. And could there be allergies already starting up? Is it this early in a baby? Can that happen?
Yes, but generally not.
Okay.
And usually if there's allergies at that age, we think more about foods than things they've ingested rather than pollens and stuff floating through the air.
So even a runny nose can have a food be because of a food allergy?
Yes.
Ah. Okay, so we should watch.
Ooh.
Or
how is
he started solids a while back, and
yeah,
now he's just trying all kinds of different things.
You know, again, I guess how much do you want to look? He's otherwise a happy, chubby, happy baby. You know, I think I'm inclined at this point in time to go along with your husband, say it's probably the daycare center, and I'd give it another month or two and see if the nose doesn't dry up.
Okay. And then, now, the other thing is I suffer from lots of rashes. My skin is really
okay.
Sensitive. And he started coming out with rashes on his forearms, and since it's been so nice, they've been putting sunscreen on him and taking him outside.
Yeah.
And now he's got rashes coming out on his forearms, particularly. And so now I'm just trying to figure out, what do I do about that? Do we continue? I mean, we definitely have to continue with the sunscreen, but what do we do as far as treating the rashes? Do we just leave them alone? Because they look almost like burns sometimes.
Okay. I suspect what's happening is, it's been nice and warm. He's probably in short sleeve shirts.
Right.
And he's probably getting rug burns and sandbox burns and, other irritants of the skin that way. And I think in general what I do is use hand lotion.
Just hand lotion?
Yeah, hand lotion or Eucerin or Vaseline or just one of those bland just lubricants.
Okay, so even if it's a rash, don't try and treat it with anything. Just keep it.
Yeah, I think right now everybody reaches for Cordate, a hydrocortisone cream.
Yeah.
And, that stuff's probably pretty safe, but it's, I don't know. Do you want to, do we need a medication for every symptom? And I think if it's a forearm thing, and knees and the outside of the legs, it's probably not an inflammatory reaction. It's probably not an allergy thing. It's probably more of a trauma thing from, just from crawling on rugs and being in the sandbox and that sort of stuff. And I think I wouldn't treat that with an anti-inflammatory steroid. I think I'd just treat that with, good cleansing and a emollient type of cream on it, a Vaseline, a Eucerin, a hand lotion.
Okay. Then something totally different is he is circumcised,
mm-hmm.
and the daycare noticed he has some white stuff coming out, but we took him into the see the pediatrician. They said that's just the dead skin cells.
Okay.
And they said to you can kind of rub it off with some baby oil or something. But how often, you know, how often should we do that? Do we wait? Do we, you know, every bath or?
Yeah, if it's just desquamating cells, you can let them take care of themselves, too.
Yeah, well, that was the other question, because we haven't really done a lot,
yeah.
And he's been fine.
Does he get a little red at the end of his penis,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, that's what that's why
yeah.
They called us, and they said that there was he was, you know, was inflamed. They thought it was a yeast infection or some kind
yeah.
of infection, so we took him in. And the doctor said, oh, no, that's pretty normal.
It is, and I think often you'll see that problem till they're not in diapers anymore.
Oh.
Because it's just, yeah, it's the end of the penis chafing against the wet diaper, and they get a little meatitis there, just a little irritation there. And I think your doctor's right. Generally, if you want to use a little Desitin A&D diaper rash cream like there, I think that's about as vigorous as I'd get.
Okay.
Because it really doesn't seem to bother him.
Okay. Now, the last question, you talk about whooping cough. How's that different from the croup? Is that totally different virus?
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay.
Whooping cough is caused by a bacteria, and croup is caused by usually respiratory syncytial virus.
Okay.
And a few other viruses, but they're much different.
Sound similar or?
No.
No, they're totally different. Okay.
Yeah. Whooping cough usually starts as a cold. Just a runny nose and a bad cough.
Okay.
And croup has that characteristic barky cough, that
right.
croupy cough.
So I didn't know if they said there was a whoop to it, but I didn't know what that really meant.
Yeah, with whooping cough, they cough. So they keep exhaling. It's this repetitive cough, so they keep exhaling till their lungs are about empty, and then they fill their lungs all of a sudden. And it's this, and it makes this whooping sound. The cough doesn't make the whooping sound. It's after the cough that they fill their lungs and they whoop on the inhalation.
I see. And then the croup is more that barking.
The croup is that barking cough.
Okay. Got it. Good. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And the whoop of the whooping cough is characteristic of preschool children. Adults and older kids, if they get whooping cough, usually won't whoop.
Okay.
They just have a progressive cough, repetitive chronic cough.
Okay, but now the infants, like he's had his shots, his vaccines and all.
Uh-huh.
And so he's pretty well protected at this point.
As far as pertussis is concerned, he should be good as gold.
Okay, good, because he doesn't, then at 12 months is his next checkup, and then he'll have some other stuff. But right now he's up to date with all his.
He should be up to date, and he should be good as gold.
Good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right, thanks for the call. Let's go to line one, and this is a listener in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. I wanted to ask about peanut allergies. I have a son who's 22 months old, and we think we've avoided peanuts so far, but I'd heard it was okay to start trying around the age of two. And then also for a second pregnancy, is it better to avoid peanuts during pregnancy and nursing in order to try to keep the child from having a peanut allergy?
Yeah, I guess why are you worried about peanut allergies? Is there a family history?
There's no family history, but and I don't know if it's just this media frenzy, but it seems like there's more and more peanut allergies, and I don't know if that's true or not.
I think, again, that's mostly media. I think the problem with peanut allergies is they can occasionally, like shellfish allergies, occasionally the allergies can lead to anaphylaxis, to a really serious blood pressure drops, throat closes, people can't breathe, people die if they don't get treatment.
The people I know who are allergic to peanuts all have that type of reaction. So even though I know there's only a small risk, it just seems like a good allergy to avoid at all costs if possible.
I think, again, if you don't have a big family history of if you and dad aren't allergic people, you probably, we can live without peanuts, can't we?
Yeah.
So I don't think he's being deprived of any vital nutrient if you leave peanuts out of his diet for a couple of years. And you are right. As the bowel matures, it tends to be more particular about what it absorbs, and it does it digests it better and absorbs smaller particles. And if the smart particle gets small enough, it's not recognized as an antigen by the body. So that's why a lot of people say, you know, avoid some of these things, the high allergic things, until the child is X number of months. Because their intestine is more mature, they're less likely to absorb whole proteins that are antigenic that will cause problems.
Okay. I was also wondering if you could talk about why breastfed babies are less likely to develop allergies, because I don't really understand that.
Okay. I'm not sure I exactly do either. Yes, you know, and I think what it boils down to maybe is what Dr. Gelis used to say all the time. I think it was Dr. Gelis, the very famous pediatrician, who said human milk is for human babies, cow milk is for baby cows. And I think that's partially, and I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think what happens with the breastfed baby is they are exposed to less allergens. You know, they generally start on solid food a little bit later. They aren't exposed to cow's milk, and cow's milk protein is certainly one of the bigger allergens, one of the allergens we worry about more often. But you know what? It's not entirely safe, because if you drink cow's milk, it is known that cow's milk antigens, whole cow's milk proteins, appear in the mother's breast milk. So it's not entirely true that the baby is 100% safe and protected from allergies.
But it only takes a couple of weeks to get that out of the mother's system, from what I understand, to keep it from going into the breast milk.
Yeah, probably less than that. I would guess probably 2 or 3 days.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Bloomington, Illinois. This is the next caller on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question about adolescence and carpal tunnel. I have a nephew who I gave a computer to my brother and his wife years ago just for their child. It was an older laptop. The kid's been using it, I got it for him when he was 4. He's about 9 or 10 now, and he's starting to sort of, you know, complain a little bit about like a numbness or a kind of a stiffness in his thumb, pointer finger, middle finger. But I also know that when it started getting warmer, that he got a tick bite, and you know they had that taken care of and stuff. And they're going to go see their pediatrician. But I was wondering, is it possible for an adolescent of 9, 10 to get carpal tunnel? And I guess another line is, if it wouldn't be carpal tunnel, is it possible that it could be like a nerve sensation thing because of possible Lyme disease?
Mm-mm. Lyme disease is a great masquerader, although, again, he's from Bloomington. You know, this is Illinois. You can get Lyme disease in Illinois, but, boy, this is, you know, you're much better off going to Wisconsin or Minnesota. You increase your odds greatly. So, I doubt it's Lyme disease.
Okay.
I can't answer that for sure. Can he get carpal tunnel? I don't think I've seen carpal tunnel at that age, but certainly anatomically he's got the stuff to develop carpal tunnel syndrome.
Okay, because they went ahead, once he started, you know, talking about the pain and stuff, I went out and got him an, you know, ergonomic mouse and keyboard, and showed him about proper stance at the computer and stuff, because I think many times he's just been kind of slouching over and reaching for it. But I kind of don't want to be the blame. He likes computers. I think he wants to go into that, but I'd hate to see it if by the time he hits college, you know, he wouldn't be able to do it because of carpal tunnel.
Yeah.
But they're going to go see their pediatrician about it and take a look at it. But you're thinking that because of where we live, Lyme disease would be a really outside possibility?
Yeah, it's possible, but it's not high on the list.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
You know, and I think the other thing this family needs to worry about is, how much time is this kid spending on that computer?
Yeah, that's something I've been talking to him about also. About, because he does all of his homework on the computer, but I think he spends a lot of time. And they monitor where he goes and stuff, but I told them, you know, you might want to be concerned about how much actual just physical time he is there keyboarding and mousing, and that might not be great for his development in the long run. But but mom and dad are both geeks also, so I think they kind of have their time when all three family members are in the same room working on their computers and stuff.
Okay.
But, Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician and a clinical assistant professor at U of I, and for a long time now has been stopping by on a regular basis on a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour to talk about children's health. And whatever questions you might have, as long as they fall within that area, you give us a call, and I know he will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455.
Fifth disease does have a name.
It does.
Erythema infectiosum.
I think I'll stick with fifth disease.
That's why it's...
so it has,
that's
it
why
has
it's
a,
fifth disease.
It has a name, but nobody can pronounce it.
That's right.
Okay.
You know, there's been some interesting stuff in the newspapers recently with summer coming on. Like this stuff with marathon runners getting water intoxicated.
Oh, yeah, right.
And we were classically taught in medicine that, you know what, don't worry about that. That just doesn't happen. And until recently, it never did. If you ever saw water intoxication, that is, yeah, the body retained too much water and diluted, and the serum sodium dropped down too much, there was pathology going on. Usually there was pathology in the brain or maybe lung cancer, and you were having the syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone is what it's called. And what that means is that our body is sending out antidiuretic hormone inappropriately. Our kidneys are sensing this, and they're retaining fluid, and it's a problem. And the treatment is fluid restriction. Well, now we're finding marathon runners, and I guess some of them have been fatalities because, and unfortunately, they're usually the poorer runners. Apparently, the good runners finish the race, and they aren't, yeah, they don't take 4 hours to finish the race. 16 people haven't shoved a cup glass of water or a sports drink in their hand, and so they haven't drunk as much. And I think the moral of the story, again, is the body works well. It's got baroreceptors. It's got chemoreceptors. It will tell you when you're thirsty. And listen to it. You don't need to stuff. Yeah. It'll listen to your body. It'll tell you what you need to do.
All right. Well, we have some other folks to talk with here. We have somebody on a cell phone. We'll go there. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, actually, I'd heard a couple of years ago in the news about some cases in the Army boot camp where they had hydro poisoning.
Yeah,
because they were really worried about people hydrating, and some of the recruits took it just too seriously.
Yeah.
But anyway, what I was going to ask you about, I guess, isn't really specifically a children's question, but it's one of those things that I remember this affected my brother when he was a kid. I am really bothered by a lot of standard skin products like deodorants and soaps and stuff like that. And I'm sure that there's plenty of parents who go through all sorts of gyrations to try to find something that works for their kids. Now, I've finally done that, but I'm wondering, is there a common ingredient that or common ingredients that should be watched out for?
My understanding is it's generally the perfuming agents, the scenting agents. So I think what you're best off with is you want to look for hypoallergenic on the label and look for unscented on the label. And the smellier the soap is, probably the more you want to avoid it if you tend to be sensitive.
Okay, so it's the perfume. Yeah, that sort of jives with my impression, but I wasn't real sure because I've even tried some unscented stuff that on occasion that ended up causing me to break out.
Yeah, and I'll bet you found that stuff was, for being unscented, it was pretty fragrant.
Geez, yeah, I don't really remember off the top of my head, but okay, so I think this makes sense, and thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks for the call. I do think that that's true, and that is that there is nothing that is truly unscented that has no smell at all. And I think that all it means is unscented. It means they have not put anything of a
real
perfume in nature, you know, like that. But whatever it is that they use in there, that does have some odor.
It needs to be appealing.
Maybe that's it. That it just does indeed have to do with consumer acceptance, you know, what people want. So you certainly don't want to, wouldn't want something that had an intensely chemical or petrochemical kind of smell to it. That wouldn't be good either.
So again, like with the deodorant, again, go unscented. You know, use an antiperspirant and go unscented. And generally those things work a little. Yeah, you're less likely to have reactions to it.
Okay, well, let's talk with a caller in Chicago. Line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Interesting program. I was listening in Chicago. I have a daughter, 5 years old, and last 3 years, every time the season starts, she got allergy, sneezing, itchy nose, and watering eyes.
Okay.
The doctor says, you know, it's seasoning, it's going to go away. But she only suggests giving the allergy medicine, the Benadryl.
Mm-hmm. And how does that work? Does that pretty much relieve her symptoms?
Yeah, it doesn't go away, you know. Let's say if you give the medicine, it will go away for one day and then come back, especially when she wake up.
Yes.
She have almost 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and sometimes her eyes swelling, you know.
You might talk to your doctor or go to the pharmacy because they make eye drops for allergic eyes. Okay. And these are over-the-counter. They've got an antihistamine in them. And they work very well for these itchy eyes because often oral medications like Benadryl seems to dry up the nose, but the eyes continue to be puffy and teary and itchy and watery and yucky. And these eye drops are quite safe. And they are often very effective. Her episodes in the morning, you're pretty much stuck with, you know, because whatever you've given her at bedtime is gone. So her symptoms are going to be until the Benadryl dose of Benadryl works in the morning. She's going to have that period of sniffing and sneezing and watery eyes and coughing and hacking and all that kind of stuff. This time of year, it's probably pollen allergies. It's beautiful down here, at least. Chicago, you're a couple weeks behind us, so you've got a little bit longer. But it's probably tree pollen. Everything's blooming. It's probably tree pollens this time of year. Spring allergies, if I can console you, spring is probably a good season to have allergies to because usually we get our spring bloom. It doesn't last very long. It's usually a short allergy season. So if her problems are in the spring, I'm sorry, but that's a good time to have allergy problems because it's usually a short season, relatively short season, as opposed to the hay fever in the fall that can be quite lengthy. It can be 2 or 3 months, whereas usually the spring allergy season is relatively short.
Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Well, thank you for the call. And again, other people who are listening, if you'd like to call in, talk with Dr. Bocek, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I came across a news item, maybe I thought I'd ask you about. Apparently, not very long ago, there was in Maine, in an elementary school in Maine, a very big outbreak of chickenpox. Enough so that the CDC went and kind of did an investigation to see what the deal was. And what it is they found, apparently, was that more than half of the students who developed chickenpox during this big outbreak had not been vaccinated. And that apparently what they were finding was that the rate of vaccinations was the highest in the youngest kids, and as they got older, every grade you went up, the percentage of kids who had gotten the chickenpox vaccine got smaller and smaller and smaller as the kids got older. So I guess that now at some point we're saying all children should have it, but are there some kids? Is there some sort of window in there where you might have some number of kids who had not had chickenpox or somehow escaped having the vaccine that you might want to think about, do you want to vaccinate these kids if they haven't had chickenpox and if they didn't get the shot?
Chickenpox is the vaccine. I think I've said often enough on this program that I think it's a good deal.
Yeah.
But not all pediatricians feel that way. Some people say, you know, chickenpox generally is no biggie by itself. We know the immunity from the disease is 100% and lifelong. We aren't that sure about the vaccine, and we still aren't that sure about the vaccine. You know, is one dose going to be enough, or they're going to need two doses and that sort of thing? So I think, and the states, I'm not sure it's still obligatory in the state of Illinois. I'm not aware of whether it is. I don't know if whether it is or not. So I think that, yeah, there is this group of kids when the vaccine first came out who's, you know, maybe their parents didn't want it because the vaccine was new, or maybe their doctor said, just let them get chickenpox. So I think there's this hole. I think that hole is disappearing because more and more people are saying, hey, this is a good, you know, this vaccine has been out long enough in the United States now. I don't want my kid to get chickenpox. I don't want to miss work, and I don't, because they're going to miss daycare. So I think this hole is filling up. But yeah, so I think the kids without unprotected by the vaccine are getting older, and given a few more years, they'll disappear.
This sort of came up actually on the last show that Dr. Jeff was here. We ended up talking about it maybe a little bit indirectly because somebody called in and had a question about shingles. And which he explained, and as you have explained, what happens is that people have chicken pox, and this is caused by a virus in the herpes family. And so you have your chicken pox, and that virus goes in the body and kind of hides. And in some people, not everybody, but some people, it comes back and it causes shingles, which can be very, very unpleasant.
Yes.
The only good thing about it is it seems that most people have an outbreak, and it only happens once.
Yeah,
it does. It doesn't
can be recurrent.
It can be recurrent,
yeah.
But apparently it's not. It's not that common. And I guess one of the questions I was wondering about, I'm not sure that I had the chance to ask him again, was this question, and maybe it is a question we really don't have a good answer for. Or what do we expect might be likely to happen with people who had gotten the chickenpox vaccine? Are they going to get is the same percentage likely to get shingles, more or less, whatever, you know? And I know the vaccine has been used in other countries
for longer than, yeah.
But, and that we haven't been doing it long enough actually to have an answer to that question.
I think what they're touting so far is there's never been a single reported case of shingles as a result of the vaccine.
Okay.
Should I say period or time will tell? Yeah.
Well, maybe
we aren't sure yet. Yeah, I think we aren't sure yet. But hopefully, all right, it is an attenuated virus. It is a live viral vaccine. So, okay, we are giving these kids chickenpox, if you will, with the vaccine. But it's an attenuated virus, so we are giving them a very weak infection of chickenpox vaccine. So let's hope if it does cause shingles, it causes a very weak shingles too.
Yeah, okay. Well, I suppose that would make... That would kind of make sense.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. But
okay. Well, we'll pretend.
But we'll leave it there anyway.
We'll leave it there. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and he's on the program once a month, always a Thursday, to take your questions about children's health. And so whatever's on your mind, as long as it's the kind of thing you would talk about with a pediatrician, you can call us 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free. 800-222-9455.
You know, the season is here. We talk about bike helmets. Yes, please wear your bike helmet. We talk about seatbelts. Yes, please wear your seatbelts. And we got booster seat law in the state of Illinois up till such and such a weight and such an age. I think we often neglect lawnmowers. And we did have a fatal lawnmower accident in this area this season. I think it was a little 3 or 4 year old girl was killed by a riding lawnmower. Kids don't belong on lawnmowers. Kids don't belong in the yard where lawns are being mowed. Neither do dogs and cats, because I can't remember the velocity that a stone or an object can come out of a chute. But a lawnmower is not a toy. It's a serious piece of machinery, and yeah. Kids shouldn't be...
Yeah, don't take them for a ride.
Don't take them for a ride. And indeed, they should be playing in the opposite yard, the front yard if you're mowing the backyard, and vice versa.
Yeah, that's a good thought. Well, we have a couple of other callers. We have someone in Decatur. This line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling about circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 3.5-year-old son that we chose not to circumcise.
Good for you.
Well, I think so. He has actually had a couple of infections. And our doctor, if what she has said is if it happens again, she thinks we should consult a urologist. She's concerned that it might, you know, be a recurring problem. What I'm really, the reason I'm calling is because I'm expecting our second son, and I'm having second thoughts about the decision that we made.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, our doctor was very kind and, you know, tried to make me feel like it wasn't my fault and I hadn't done anything wrong. We do, you know, we try, of course, he's bathed regularly and we try to make sure that he's clean. And but for whatever reason, he's still contracted a couple of infections where he just gets irritated and it's uncomfortable for him, and we've had an antibiotic. It clears up right
okay.
away. But
so it gets red. It's more than the white secretions underneath the foreskin.
Right. He has had that a couple of times, and it's cleared up on its own in 24 hours.
Yeah.
You know,
because that's normal. Without redness, just that white pasty stuff underneath the foreskin, that's perfectly normal. That's supposed to be there.
It is. Okay.
Yeah.
Because we've had that happen several times. And the first time we went to the pediatrician, well, we go to a family practitioner, but the first time we went and she gave us an antibiotic and it cleared up. When it happened the second and third time, we waited 24 hours because we were a little more informed, and it cleared up on its own. This last time, he became red and even swollen, and it was sore to the touch. And again, the antibiotic cleared it up, you know, immediately. I'm just wondering, I guess, what your opinion is on circumcision. If there's some advice about what to do with the next one, if we don't circumcise. I got kind of you know, I was told to be sure we pull it back, but don't pull it back too far.
Does his foreskin retract?
Yes. The family practitioner felt like it didn't retract perhaps as much as most.
Okay.
But yes, it does.
You know, it might be worth a trip to the urologist because it's, you know, I think there's a lot of physicians that haven't seen an uncircumcised male boy because in this country, we whack off the foreskins of most male children. Why do we do it? Because we've always done it. And I think we are one of the few countries in the world that does do it. Europe doesn't do it. Canada doesn't do it. Africa doesn't do it. South America doesn't do it. We are one of the few countries that thinks more or less thinks that universal circumcision is something that should be done. And is there any good medical evidence that says all boys should be circumcised, that the foreskin is superfluous skin? What in the world is it there for? Let's take it off. There seems to be no good medical reason to circumcise little boys.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is some evidence that there is less sexually transmitted disease in boys that have been circumcised than boys who are left uncircumcised. And I guess that makes sense because there is a foreskin, so there's a place to hide. Yeah, there's a place for bugs to hide in. But generally, you don't need. Generally, I mean, mankind is about 1 million years old. I think it's estimated the foreskin's been there for 1 million years. You know, why hasn't it? Yeah, why hasn't evolution taken it away? And in general, I will support your decision not to circumcise them and not to circumcise again. I think maybe the problem is that a visit to your urologist or somebody who's seen and who knows what to do about uncircumcised penises might be worthwhile. Okay. And yeah, just how to, you've elected not to circumcise him. I will support him. I don't think there's a reason to circumcise him, but yeah, how do I take care of this? And it sounds like your family practitioner, who may be a wonderful doctor, I think is a bit, it sounds like she's a bit inexperienced
She's very young.
And yeah.
She's and very kind, and we like her.
Yeah.
But she is a young woman, so that, I hadn't really thought about that, but
yeah,
that could be that.
She just doesn't, yeah, she's not very experienced with the uncircumcised penis.
Okay.
And somebody who...
So it might be good to get a second opinion, not necessarily
yeah,
take just, any action, but
yeah,
just to get...
Just how do I take care of this penis?
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, thanks for the call. I wonder, in this particular case, you know, supposing that you did, you had two boys, and the first one you decided that you would not circumcise, but maybe you had some problems, so the second one came along, you're thinking, well, maybe you will. Do you think that there would be a problem for these two brother between these two brothers
yeah,
if one guy's penis looks one way and the other guy's penis looks different?
Yeah, data. You know what? Data doesn't seem to support that.
Oh, okay.
Because I often wondered. Yeah, I often. In fact, I asked my uncircumcised patients when they were teenagers, "Have you ever gotten hassled in the locker room or any place else?" And the answer was universally, "No,
no,"
because okay, you know what? That kid's penis with the foreskin still attached looks a little funny compared to mine. But you know what? It is a centimeter longer. So I better, you know.
It's just not a subject for discussion.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to go
yeah,
there.
And I don't know what goes on in the girls' locker room as far as talking about breast size, but I bet you it's similar.
Yeah. Okay. Southern LaSalle County. It's somebody else here. Line number one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I don't want to insinuate I'm in my second childhood, but I think all this happened back in Gerald Ford's era. But I try to insinuate that my mother and dad should go get the swine flu, and of course they didn't, but I'm the only one that did. Has there ever been any repercussions about that?
The swine flu, I think that's the one that caused Guillain-Barré syndrome, wasn't it?
I really don't remember. It's just they pushed it so much, you know,
yeah,
I did it.
Yeah, there was one year where the vaccine caused a few cases of spinal cord injury from the reaction from the vaccine, and I think that was the swine flu.
But, I can ask you another question quickly.
Uh-huh.
Now I have connected with the spine. I have peripheral neuropathy. You think there's any connection?
Probably not.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're
I
welcome.
I thought I'd take a point of your dull time there.
All right, well,
enjoying it as always.
Thank Great, you. Thank you.
Just on the subject now that I'm thinking about, on the subject of the flu vaccine, of course, now everybody knows a story about what happened this year.
No flu vaccine. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was another thing that it seemed that, well, first of all, we had this problem with, we have all of the flu vaccine is made by one or two
yeah,
companies, and one of them, someone decided that there was a problem with their manufacturing process, and they decided that that vaccine, all the vaccine that they had produced, couldn't be used. And they decided that pretty late in the game, and not, it was too late for anybody else to go back and make more flu vaccine because it takes a
yeah,
little while. And so back last fall, the time normally people would get shots, we said, now look, if you're in one of the high risk groups, please do get the shot. We've got enough for you. But if you're not, you just cross your fingers and, you know, do your best. And in fact, it was actually not considering that we had
yeah,
all these people that weren't vaccinated. We didn't have any kind of huge problems. Now, I guess what I'm wondering about is, what about next fall? Do we now think that we won't have that same kind of problem next fall?
I would hope, and I think that they've gotten, yeah, that they've... Yeah, there will be enough manufacturers, so if one for some reason is not approved, there will be enough. My understanding is, yeah, they've covered themselves,
okay,
so there will be enough sources.
Seems like, you know, one of the morals was that if it's something that you really are going to depend on, you'd better not only have one or two
yeah,
companies making it all for you, because if something goes wrong, then
you're
up yeah, the creek.
Yeah. And again, yeah, like you said, I think this year we were fortunate. We were unfortunate that the vaccine, there was a problem with the vaccine. We were fortunate that this wasn't the big flu year.
Yeah.
And you don't know what year's going to, yeah. you're guessing what to put in the vaccine, and you're guessing whether you're going to need it at all. But again, I will go. I like vaccines. I think they're. I think it is relatively inexpensive insurance, and I like vaccines. And next fall, or next September, October,
if they have one, you'll
I'll
be
yelling about. Yeah, right. I'll be pushing it.
All right. Well, at that, we're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. I'm sorry we have a caller we can't take, but we've just run out of our time. Next month, of course, Dr. Bocek will be back. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Robert Bocek, he's a pediatrician. He's also a clinical assistant professor at the University of Illinois. Once a month, he's on the show. Always on a Thursday, we talk about children's health. Programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. The broadcast also today made possible by a grant from Horeen's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horeen's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, one of their regular features, it's the show that they call Computers and You. They do that on the third Thursday of the month, and the guest this time around will be the science and technology reporter for the News Gazette newspaper, Greg Klein. So if you have some problem related to a computer, you got some problem you don't quite know how to solve, or maybe you're thinking about taking your first plunge and going out and buying a computer and you need a little advice, any and all of that is certainly welcome. That's during the 1 o'clock hour of the show. The program itself gets underway at noon. There'll be news from NPR, the BBC, AM 580, all of that. And the host for the program is Celeste Quinn. The Afternoon Magazine starts at noon today. Coming up in the next hour of this program, Focus 580, we will be talking about Tibet and the opposition by Tibetans to the invasion of China back in 1950. The guest is Michael Dunham. He is a writer, artist, and photographer who became interested in Tibet. Actually, his way into the story was he was interested in Tibetan art and met some Tibetans who had taken part in this resistance and decided this was a story that needed to be told. So he's written a book about it after a number of years of work interviewing people who were involved. The book is titled Buddha's Warriors, The Story of the CIA-backed Tibetan Freedom Fighters, The Chinese Invasion, and the Ultimate Fall of Tibet. And you can hear that in the next hour of Focus. Right now, though, we're going to break, as we usually do. We'll have news at a minute past before that, an update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
WILL, Urbana, NPR, and more for Central Illinois. It's